Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is a space where we seek to create and cultivate healthy conversations between those things we geek out on and the philosophical and theological questions that often arise out of our fandoms. Like, what does it mean to be human? What makes a hero? What makes a villain? How do the stories and narratives we geek out on shape how we live in the world? We are your priest to the geeks. We aren't all ordained, but we see ourselves as mediators at the intersection of geek culture and going deeper in our faith. We don't always have to agree, but we do respect each other, and we see everyone as a beloved child of God. Everyone geeks out on something, so come geek out with us and enjoy the show.
This show is a proud member of the On Us All Podcast Network.
Has your bookshelf ever tried to talk to you? If so, maybe it was you or us all along. Hello, friends. Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology and another episode of our spring series On Loop, our spring bonus series. We do this every season in January, spring, summer, Halloween, Christmas, and here we are in the spring. And here's our bonus series where we are discussing time loop movies, tying it into our annual theme of faces behind us. And I'm really excited to talk about this particular film with a fellow geekologist and one of my favorite scientists and geeks around, Andy Walsh. Andy, how are you doing? Are you ready to tackle this challenge to speak about or talk about this 2 hour and 45 minutes movie in 30 minutes or less? Can we do it?
We absolutely can. We'll just get that Hans Zimmer organ pumping us up.
That's right. We may have to hop into a black hole to get this done, but we'll figure it out. Or we're going to tap into Brandon Knight's energy with Kung Fu Pizza Party and do this 30 minutes or less. So let's do it. Let's hop right in. Okay, Andy, let's pretend that you and I are both at a faith and science conference, and we're sitting in a room full of our favorite theologians and scientists, and we have some free time. And so it was our idea to put up Interstellar, because we all have 3 hours of free time that we can't wait to watch this movie together. And we just want to see the reaction of everybody in the room after we watched it and have an incredible conversation around it. We watched this movie. What's the first thing you share or the first thing that comes in your mouth after the credits start rolling?
You know, when I think about this movie in this particular moment, the scene that jumps out to me is the scene in the principal's office with Principal David Oluguo and the conversation about the science textbooks and whether you know, what's the true history of the space program and all that. And yeah, just, it's hard to shake how prescient, not that it was entirely prescient in the sense that that sort of thing had already happened, right? So we knew that could happen again, because the desire to control what's in the textbooks and decide what's true has reared its head before. And man, we feeling that sting again.
Yes, we are. So yeah, this movie is set in 2067. It's a different environment, different climate, sense of urgency. There's science, pseudoscience, suppression of science, NASA going underground to do some of these things. And this movie was made in 2014. So some of this, 12 years ago was foreshadowed in this particular movie. I think for me, the geek in me, and I like Christopher Nolan's movies, I'm like thinking in my head, oh my gosh, he did Batman. So great. Ah, he did a movie on dreams, Inception, and now he's doing one on space, kind of a throwback 2001 Space Odyssey, and doing that. Man, this guy can do it all. And then immediately I get up and I try to find my daughter to give her a big hug, because that got me in the feels, his relationship to his family and his daughter, and staying or not, or going, and time, and what is time, and time is precious and a resource. All that is just swirling in my head and heart. And I'm running to go see my family and friends and give them big hugs after this movie, for sure. All right, Andy. Yeah, I like what we share there in terms of with this movie and what our first reactions are. But if, you know, someone's never seen it, in particular, a fellow geekologist who sometimes edits these podcasts often, or the only one who edits these podcasts, have never seen this movie. And we are going to share a summary of like a 2 or 3 minute summary of this movie. Andy, you're up for the task to condense a 2-hour and 45-minute movie down to 2 or 3 minutes.
Let's see.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, as you mentioned, we're a little bit in the future. Climate change has proceeded apace. Crops are failing. Population numbers seem to be dwindling. Folks are kind of hanging on. And there is the hope that maybe, you know, there is actually a planet B. And, you know, just about everybody has given up on that idea. But our protagonist, played by Matthew McConaughey, has some faith and starts investigating some curious things that happen to his farming equipment. And that leads him to the underground NASA that you mentioned. And it turns out that there have been these NASA scientists toiling away for years, building a space program to visit other planets. A wormhole has opened up out near, is it Saturn? Somewhere out in the solar system.
Yep.
And we have the ability to travel to distant planets in other solar systems. We've sent some probes, and now it is time to follow up on those probes to see if, to think about actually relocating people to these planets. And so a mission, a small number of people are launched on this mission. They go through the wormhole. They check out a couple planets. Back on Earth, Matthew McConaughey's daughter has grown up and is also connected to the space program and is trying to solve the problem of how to get everybody else off of Earth and onto the new planet, right? So Matthew McConaughey's leading a small expedition of a handful of people in a small craft to figure out which one of these planets is the right one to send people to. And then his daughter, played by Jessica Chastain, is trying to figure out how to get the rest of the people to that planet to sort of restart the human race and Earth ecology on a new planet. And nice. Some perils ensue. And, you know, maybe since some people haven't seen the movie, we won't totally spoil how that worked out and some of the twists and turns along the way.
Right.
But yeah, that's kind of what they're trying to achieve.
Yeah. So you have this sense of urgency of not only what's happening on Earth, but there's a lot of quantum mechanics, quantum theory, theory of relativity, time, space, and how that works and the bending of time. And so there's another sense of urgency within the movie of time operates differently on other planets with different gravitational pulls or happen to be nearby a black hole, and the time they have in space in relationship to the time that's going on in Earth is a sense of urgency. Will they ever see their family again? Will they see their friends again? Will they... you know, will they age at a different rate than they will or do? And what how does that affect their relationship? So there's these family dynamics along with urgency for saving all of humankind. And really, you have this kind of like cosmic trolley problem of, do I see my family, stay with my family, love my family, or there's a whole human race. There's millions of people who are going to be affected by the decisions that are made by the people who are going out and scoping out the cosmos to look for a planet. And there's this kind of mystery of other people who have gone before who aren't coming back, find them. There's clues. There's perhaps some alien life form that put it there. Who are they that are helping them find where they need to be? So all that's kind of the mystery that's unfolding as you get towards the end of this movie. Yeah. It's fantastic. I love it. I can't recommend it enough. Andy, what's your thoughts? Do you recommend this movie? Was it a good choice to show it to a bunch of people in a room at a faith and science conference?
I think so. I really loved the movie when I saw it, when it came out with my wife. We were so excited about the movie that we said, oh, our son, who was 9 at the time, like he's getting into the space and science and things. He'll really like this movie. And that was a mistake. I went with him. A second trip and underestimated how challenging the emotional content of the film would be. And that the sci-fi of it did not overweigh the emotional heaviness. So that was a bit of a mistake, but I think a room full of adults at a faith and science conference, absolutely a great call. And then for the 10th anniversary a couple of years ago, they re-released it in theaters. And I got to take my dad to see it. He had not seen it before, and he was blown away by it. He thanked me for taking him. He's like, you know, there are images in this film that will stick with me for the rest of my life that, you know, were worth seeing on the big screen. So
I do recommend seeing it on the biggest screen you can have and the best sound system you have, because there are certain moments that you're definitely being manipulated by the soundtrack and these big organ religious swells that are coming. And we'll talk about other kind of swells that emerge on the horizon as well. But in terms of this organ music and the emotion of it is huge. I saw this in the theater too. You know, I saw the Batman trilogy or the two that had come out already in Inception and was a fan of Christopher Nolan and said, I like space. I like cosmology. I like the stars. And went to this movie. It's not a sci-fi shoot 'em up lasers, lightsabers movie, but in terms of the urgency of trying to find aliens or planets and save humankind, is fantastic. But it's been a long time since I've seen this movie. And I think I saw it in the theater, maybe one other time, not in the theater, but it's been a while. So I had forgotten really some beats along the way. And I was like, oh, I think I forgot how this ended. And I know the memes and the isolated parts of Matthew McConaughey and Coop looking at the TV and crying and his reaction and people splicing like Star Wars trailers alongside of his reaction, you know, taking it out of context and making a reaction video of his crying and laughing and holding his face. And so that part, it was kind of hard to watch that scene again without thinking about all the memes that are in culture with that and the movie part of like him, you know, literally hearing from his family. But yeah, I had forgotten along the way kind of what happened in this movie. I knew some big beats and favorite moments, but it was like watching it anew. And again, yeah, I love it. It's got a lot of big emotion, a lot of, I think the urgency and the themes definitely hold up in our current context in our present world today. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about our annual theme about the people and faces behind us or behind the main characters. And really, you know, I alluded to what is I don't know if we want to spoil it all for our folks. It's an old movie, but in terms of like a bookshelf and people talking and communicating and who are they, who are thus, that Cooper is a NASA pilot who is literally the face behind him and his family giving messages in a time loop. I feel like this whole spring series was created for this movie, Andy. That's what we're talking about when it comes to the faces behind literally us. How do you tie that in to our annual theme?
Yeah, I guess it's hard not to spoil it and acknowledge the connection to that theme.
Yeah.
I think I was the one that put this forward. If we're talking about, you know, the people behind the people, the people behind the faces or whatever, that, you know, an interesting wrinkle on that is all these time travel movies where people wind up being their own, causal agent, right?
Yeah.
And in this film, there is the claim, and I haven't investigated this fully, but there's the claim that gravity and gravity waves can travel across space-time in different ways than light can, and allowing you to create these closed time-like curves. I know that the closed time-like curves are a valid solution to general relativity equations, right? So I guess that is what they're drawing inspiration from. So Matthew McConaughey's character figures out how to use, at the end of the film, needs to send information back about the planet and how to get there and all that. It needs to send that back to Earth and needs to send that back in time, or figures out that if he can send it back in time, that will solve his issues. And so he finds himself in a five-dimensional space that has a convenient interface to his farmhouse back on Earth in the, you know, in the time before he left.
Yep.
That allows him to send signals back, you know, through these gravitational waves or other kind of gravitational signal. And at first that manifests as just sort of knocking some books off a bookshelf, and eventually he's able to encode some Morse code in the placement of books, and then in the hesitation of a second hand on a watch. And so all these mysterious clues that as the film unfolds for the first time at the beginning, all these clues about are there ghosts in the house or what, all these strange things that are happening, the things that point them to this hidden NASA installation that they should have no way of knowing about. Mm-hmm. All of it winds up being helpful for, you know, all of it winds up having come from Matthew McConaughey in the future, sending it back to the past. And then the last piece of the puzzle is he sends to his adult daughter after he had left the information about how to manipulate gravity such that they can get a large ship out of the gravity well of Earth with the resources that they have. That was the puzzle that she was trying to solve. And he provides her with the data that she needs to solve that puzzle to be able to get the ship off of Earth and headed towards the new planet.
Yeah. Well done there. Perfect. And you also, like, it literally is a loop. Like, if we're talking about on loop, it is a loop, because the first message is he's like, gives to himself is stay. Don't leave. You're literally wasting your time, because it's a trap. There's betrayal. There's backstabbing. There's secrets and lies and not being told all the information. So he's like, stay with your family, stay with your daughter. But then she figures it out, because there's this kind of a AI robot that I've never seen a shape robot like this before, called TARS. It's not an acronym. I looked it up. Is there a particular acronym? No. Maybe it's just like playing a word with star or TARS. But TARS has like a AI regular human voice, and while he's in the middle of a literal black hole, are working out and send more messages. So I'm glad he didn't stay. He didn't listen to himself with that first message, and then eventually was able to pass on other messages to his daughter. And I really enjoyed that part. Yeah, wrapping my head around the science of it all and picking up clues here and there. And does the science hold up? Is this something that, you know, in terms of your own research, I mean, I'm sure there's some particle physicists and quantum physicists who may have bones to pick with this, but I wonder, I didn't get too deep on whether Nolan did his homework or not when it comes to gravity, time, relativity, all that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, homework was done. There is a point where the science becomes science fiction, right? I mean, that's otherwise, it would be a documentary.
Yeah.
But there's definitely some serious science and thought about the science that has gone into this film. Kip Thorne is the big name, was the physicist advisor on this project. He would go on to win the Nobel Prize, I think, just 3 years after the film came out, for his role in helping to construct the detectors that detected the first gravitational waves.
Nice.
He was a big figure in sort of black hole research and general relativity research. It's intersectional science fiction. He has a book, Black Holes and Time Warps, I think is the name of the book.
I'm gonna go look it up. Okay.
That he had written in the 90s or early 2000s. It actually makes an appearance. Tobey Maguire's Peter Parker is reading that book, or has that book in a stack of things that he's carrying around in one of the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies.
Uh-oh. There you go.
So Kip Thorne has been interested in this topic for a long time. So he was the main advisor. I'm sure there were other people as well. The computational model that they built to render the massive black hole that makes an appearance in the film and provides some of the more stunning visuals. So to just generate those visuals, they had to create a mathematical model of how a black hole and the matter around it would work. Mm. And that black hole simulation was at the time the highest resolution, sort of highest detail simulation that had ever been done of a black hole of that sort, such that actual research papers were able to be published based on using that model to probe questions about black hole physics and so forth. So yeah, so there's some heavy duty science involved in this film. Some folks who are black hole fans may be familiar with the concept of spaghettification.
Yep.
Idea that the difference as you approach a black hole, the difference in gravity between your head and your feet is so great that it'll kind of stretch you out and render you not alive anymore, but more like stretched out like spaghetti or Mr. Fantastic.
Yeah.
And so you might wonder, you know, so when they get really close to a black hole, you might wonder why doesn't that happen? You know, why does Matthew McConaughey get stretched out and killed that way and his spaceship? And it turns out that the black hole that they're dealing with, because it is spinning and because it is so massive, you can be close to the event horizon, and the difference in gravity is actually not that big. Just like, because you're so far away from the center of mass, the difference in gravity between your head and your feet really isn't all that big of a deal. Just like, you know, the difference between the gravity of the Earth between your head and your feet is not a problem for day to day. So nice. Yeah, it is possible to get a black hole big enough that spaghettification is not an issue. So that's based on real science. That wasn't a mistake. That is real general relativity and black hole science. The idea that time slows down when you're that close to a black hole. There's a planet that's really, really close to the event horizon of the black hole, and so time elapses much more slowly on the surface of the planet. That's real general relativity work. You know, the exact factor of the time dilation, maybe, you know, they had to fudge to make the story of the film work. I'm not sure about that, but certainly the concept is valid. So yeah, lots to dig into. There's a whole book about the science of interstellar. I think it might be called The Science of Interstellar, mm-hmm. with some nice images of the black hole and other things. So yeah, if folks want to dig in, there's plenty to find there.
That's fascinating. And the work, the thing about the work that went into this to create this movie, write it, produce it, put it out there, and the homework behind it just absolutely amazes me. And, you know, did win an Oscar for best visual effects. And as you're watching it and seeing what they're capturing on the screen in terms of the reality or realness of space, being in space, all those things, and planets, it deserved it. It deserved that award for sure. And when you talk about like the faces behind us, and he's the one literally communicating to himself and his daughter and those on Earth that kind of solve this huge math equation of the problem they have before them. I not too long ago, when all these stuff was coming out about UAPs and government releasing files and Navy pilots seen and showing camera footage of unidentified aerial phenomena, UAPs out in the world, my wife turned to me and said, "What if it's us? What if that's us from a different dimension or time? Coming back to observe and learn from our mistakes or give us warnings or something." And that's always stuck with me too. It's like, in light of watching this again, we had a nice conversation after we watched the movie about UAPs and what it could be. Maybe it's us. Maybe they're not ghosts. Maybe they aren't like aliens wanting to take over and put us in a zoo, but maybe it's us all along, or somebody like us from a different dimension. I think it's neat to think about. Andy, what are some other things in terms of about this movie you loved or didn't love, or kind of thinking a little deeper when it comes to what this movie will lead? I mean, there's a lot of religious imagery when it comes to calling the project Lazarus. They talk about the stars and dust. Here I am in the season of Lent, coming off Ash Wednesday, and we're getting closer to Holy Week and talking about dust. We are just dust or stardust, and what. Love of family, love being a powerful force, just as strong as gravity, Bran says in the movie at one point, this kind of metaphysical understanding of a phenomenon, not just data and science. But what are some other things there that you love or don't love or cause you to scratch your head?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just, it's not necessarily deep, but, you know, we've talked about the music for the film, but, you know, I can't say enough about how much I enjoy the music of the film, especially there's a cue called No Time for Caution that comes at a particularly dramatic, intense bit of the film that, yeah. You know, is probably one of my top, you know, five cues from film scores of the past, you know, probably of this century. And yeah, so that's a great aspect of the film. You know, I struggle with the idea. So there's an element of, you know, it the film is addressing climate change. It's not speaking necessarily directly about climate change, or it just sort of takes it as a given, right? And sort of wrestles with what are the consequences of that, rather than, you know, is it real or what's going to happen exactly or whatever. You know, there is on the one sense an idea of like we're all we have, right? And the idea that, you know, this closed loop, right, that we're the ones that have to help ourselves. There's no rescue ship coming. There's no whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we're going to have to be the ones that solve this problem. At the same time, the way that we solve the problems are, you know, somewhat fantastical and, you know, stretching into the supernatural. And so, yeah, I kind of struggle with, well, is that really a hopeful message or a discouraging message? I'm not really sure. I think it wants to be hopeful, or at least encouraging, that, you know, there's work to be done, get out and do the work. And, you know, there may be ways to find, there may be solutions out there that we got to find, but we got to put in the work. The idea that kind of takes, you know, magic of reverse time travel and the solutions can only come from the future, coming back to the past, maybe undermines that a little bit. I think it's also worth saying, you know, you mentioned about love being a, you know, powerful force. There's a way in which that can come across as sappy, but I think we underestimate, right, that while it's not a force in the same way that you can measure it and quantify it and detect it with a device or a contraption, right, and that it, you know, it has a constant field or an equation that we can write down, it doesn't mean that it's not a real force in the world. It does, you know, it has real causal power. People do extraordinary things because of love and hate and fear and, you know, joy and hope, right? All these emotions, which are not tangible and which you can't hold in your hand, are nevertheless real because of the way in which they impact humans and thus humans impact, you know, the world around us. And, you know, I don't think there's anything, I think we shy away from that sometimes because it feels squishy or romantic or whatever. But, you know, I think we can assert without having to, you know, stray from being scientific and grounded in the physical world. I think we still assert that, no, these things are real things. There is a reality to them. Just because they are not material doesn't mean that they're not real, and doesn't mean that they don't have profound consequences and profound influence. I mean, you know, how to compare it to the strength of gravity, you know, I don't know. But that doesn't mean that it's not real.
Yeah, and I think they do a good job with those discussions there, because they talk about not only gravity and time and relativity and equations that come with that, but also evolution and survival instincts and attachments. And you can look at that through a scientific lens too, in terms of how we evolve as a species and how we survive as a species. But then just as, you know, there was a time when we couldn't calculate or understand gravity, the theory of relativity and gravity waves, love is a powerful force as well. To lean in to that too, I think it does a good job without being too sappy, but then talking about the tension or the difference between just evolutionary survival instincts within humans, and then also our attachments and love, what drives our decision and how to help other people and the ones we love. I think they do a good job, really, really good job with that. Another big part, of course, I loved about this movie is you have a giant wave, and they actually surf one of the big, it's over 100-foot wave. If you watch the HBO special, The Quest for the 100-foot Wave, well, there are planets that may have those big tsunami-like waves, and this spaceship literally surfs it. And I was like, "Yeah, here we go. We got a surfing scene in my sci-fi movie. I'm down. I'm very excited about that." And that just that wave coming at them, and the urgency, and then turning. It was so good. Really well done. I'll say that it is long. It's a long movie. It's 2 hours and 45 minutes. They hang on scenes really long sometimes, and they draw it out. There's not three acts. There's four acts, and it just keeps going. But I think if there's a throwback to 2001 Space Odyssey and space, and I think he's tapping into some of that, those vibes and what came before it in terms of sci-fi, I think it's done really, really well. So I wouldn't edit much out of this movie when it comes to the soundtrack and the organ swells and literal ocean swells and water and the relationships that are there, the age ups, age downs, all that stuff is totally worth it. So go see it, folks. Go see it. And yeah, you know, are we doing a 2-hour and 45-minute movie justice by doing this in 30 minutes or so? No. And so should we do another whole episode on this particular film after Joshua watches it? Yes, we should. And that's kind of what we're doing with these bonus series, is to kind of tap into a little bit of some of our favorite movies and favorite themes. And then hopefully later on down the road, talk about it a little bit more. So this is just a tease and a lure that maybe we'll go even deeper into the black hole of Interstellar here at some point in the near future. Andy, I'm sure there's something tonight that I'm going to think about. I wish I said, and then maybe I'll come back and flash the lights in my office and be me communicating with myself to make sure I don't forget something to say. But I don't know. Is there anything that you're going to be disappointed when we wrap this up that you're going to be, I wish I said this about this movie?
Well, you know, we haven't even talked about Matt Damon. And that whole, you know, he lures them to a planet. He's the only one who survives the initial visit to those planets, and he lures them to his planet to rescue him. but it turns out that maybe it's not the ideal place for them. And that's the whole thing. And, you know, I think that's a good illustration of, you know, fear as a powerful motivator as well. And, and I think that speaks to our present moment also.
100%.
You know, just, you know, wrestling with why he does what he does and what we would do in the same situation.
Yeah, I think that's a good moral dilemma that they're in there. And yeah, the cast in this movie is just outstanding. And how Christopher Nolan could get all these A-list celebrities in one movie is incredible. But yeah, the cast, it just people kept rolling out. Like, isn't that so-and-so? Isn't that so-and-so? Oh my gosh, I forgot about this. This person's in it. And it just kept going and going. So yeah, fantastic. Cool. Well, that's it, folks. Let us know what you think. What you think about the movie. How you think this ties into our annual theme. Go back and check the show notes for the playlist and all those things. Our closing question here, you know, as we wrap up, as we loop back around, Andy and I have been on other episodes you can find in the show note of with the spring series on loop. And so we're going to, you know, the closing question is going to be a little different this time. Do a little different. You can hear what we say on other episodes about the main one. But, you know, if there was a movie that we could go back in time and change a decision with that particular movie, Andy, what movie would it be and what decision would it be if you could go back in time and change a movie decision?
You know, it's probably just because we've got Avengers Doomsday on the brain and, you know, Kevin and Christian and I talked about, you know, are kind of building up to that and doing a whole other series. I'm prepping for that, but
yeah,
the Doomsday prepping. But it occurred to me, you know, they kind of did Ant-Man dirty a little bit with using the third Ant-Man movie to set up Avengers, the Kang Dynasty that isn't ever going to happen. So yeah, I would like to go back and see what the third Ant-Man movie would have been if they had a better sense of what their actual plans were going to be and how the
nice,
you know, how the phase 5 and 6 were gonna pan out.
I like it. That's a good decision. A little bit deeper than mine. A little greater ramifications than mine. But I would go back and I would say, Lucas, come on, man, let's make these Ewoks Wookiees. You know, I mean, that was the original plan. I get it that this scale of hope and a little guy beating the huge empire. I get that hobbification of terms of how we do movies and who wins or not. But I would love to see just in that Return of the Jedi, just a planet of Wookiees going to town on the empire. So yeah, that's probably what I'll do right now. There's a lot of Star Wars ones I want to go back. The sequel trilogy, prequel trilogy, all kinds of decisions that would be like, oh, come on. But right now, comes to mind, I would love to see it in Return of the Jedi. That's, yeah. Come at me, y'all. Come at me. Send your angry emails to willrose@interstellar.net and I will answer back. Hey, folks, thanks. Rate, review, share, chime in on the polls. A lot of these movies are done because our fans in people on social media voted for them. So we hope that you can be a part of that and do that in the future. And if your bookshelf ever talks to you, please pay attention because the geek in me honors the geek in you.
We just wanted to take a moment to ask you all to consider sponsoring our show. You can do so by becoming a member in the website down in the show's description. It takes a lot to keep this show running as far as editing equipment, paying the site that platforms our show to all the different mediums where you listen to your podcast, going to events. There's a lot of costs behind this. And I was thinking of the most fun way to do this ad, and I was going to do like, you know, one of those songs where it's like, there's a log on the lake. And then by the end, it's like, there's a speck in the eye of the flea on the log on the lake or something. Then I realized that would just take too long and I don't want to bore you guys. I'm going to list some of the benefits you can get for being a member as a thank you to those who do take some of their funds to help sponsor our show. At the free tier, you get some perks, including like free episodes. Yeah, you don't even have to pay to get extra content that goes along with our annual theme or even in collaboration with the Rethinking Faith. We're going to be doing Rethinking Comics and you can get that on our website if you want to follow that series. As you move up to some of the paid tiers, you get access to exclusive merch only for our sponsors. You get access to the bonus questions we do each thing and all kinds of things that are like shout outs for all tiers. You can get a shout out on the episode. All of the tiers come with some incredible benefits. As you go through some of the different ones moving up, you know, you get different percent off of our merchandise. We just straight up give you money towards purchasing stuff. Some of the tiers just get $10 a month to buy stuff from us. We do free giveaways. Some of the tiers come with birthday presents, Christmas presents. free t-shirt for our members. There are lots of things that we do because we just want to show our appreciation for those who are able to take their funds and sponsor our show. But we also want to remind you, whether or not you can financially support the show, we appreciate everyone who takes their time to listen to this. Remember that verse that's like, perhaps you're here for a time such as this. Well, perhaps you're here for a time such as sponsoring our show, or perhaps you're not here to listen to ads, and I should wrap this up.
This show is a proud member of the Onazal Podcast Network. Other shows on the network include Be Living Water, where Joshua Knoll discusses various topics from a Taoist Christian perspective, inviting listeners to imitate Christ and be water, beneficial to all, and a conflict with none. Friday Night Frights, O'Day and Christian Ashley discuss all things frightful, from UFOs to the paranormal to serial killers and more. Kung Fu Pizza Party, where Brandon discusses all things martial arts media, delivering high-flying action and wisdom, one slice at a time, all in under 30 minutes. And my other show, with Christy Whaley, Theology on the Rocks, where two theology PhDs talk about our lives, the world, and theology, all over drinks, clearly. Come on over each week to hear two besties discuss academic nerd stuff while also banter endlessly, especially if wine is involved.